Hi, it's The World in Words. This is Patrick Cox, and we have a special guest today.
I'm back, Patrick.
You can't
keep me away. I'm so sorry. Today, actually, I'm back because I have a few holdover stories or stories that like I've reported and I've wanted to sort of bring to the show. And this one is with our colleague, Leo Hornack in London. He's our BBC producer.
It's good to be back. It's good to be back.
And today we've brought you a detective story.
So wait a minute, you two have been reporting on a detective story? Tell me about that.
So late last year, Nina paid a visit to London and the two of us started working on this story and we got pretty entranced by this sleuthing story. It's got everything that a good game of Clue should have.
And except candlesticks.
Except candlesticks. I'm just going to set the scene for you where this begins. So every good detective story needs a moment where a crime is uncovered. And just like in Clue, this one begins in a library. And the weapon is a poem.
Yes, a poem.
The crime is stealing one poem and passing it off as your own.
You know, Leo, there's actually a word for that. It's called plagiarism.
Thank you for the education,
yes.
Nina.
Yes. And our detective in this story is a man named Ira Lightman.
So one day, the poet Ira Lightman stared at his laptop screen in disbelief. Could it be true? A poem by the up-and-coming poet Christian Ward was looking a little bit fishy.
So we called up a remote library in rural Britain to double-check the poem.
I was really startled.
What he wants to find out was if the poem he was looking at on his laptop by Christian Ward was based in some way, was stolen in some way from the work of another poet. And he called the librarian who housed the original poetry magazine of the other poet and asked her to read the original poem down the phone.
All that I was hearing over the phone was the exact same wording with he changed to she and two place names changed pretty much. And the librarian herself was in a certain amount of shock and disbelief. So I suppose between the two of us, we shared that kind of reaction of shock. I genuinely didn't believe it could happen.
Yeah, it was basically a full-on copy, word for word. Except for, what does he say, he and she.
Father became mother in the plagiarized version. The River X, which is a river here in Britain, became Ullapool. And so, yeah, and there were some other sort of small alterations. But basically, Patrick, this was one poem by one poet called Helen Mort, passed off as the work of another poet, stolen.
So who is this bloke, Ira Lightman?
Bloke, I like that word. He's like your lovable uncle, you know. I mean, picture a poet, Patrick. I don't know if you could picture a poet in sort of broad, I guess, stereotypes.
Shall I compare thee to a summer's day?
Right, exactly.
Or sort of like Wordsworth lying in the long grass with his legs crossed and looking up to the sky and using a quill.
I imagine that Ira has a quill, I don't know, at his home. He's kind of have big wild hair, red trousers, sort of handlebar mustache beard.
He's like a kind of friendly, eccentric uncle. I mean, a lot of his poems are quite playful. His poetry is not so much of the, like, dreaming of the of other worlds as kind of all about wordplay and sounds.
The game of available hog, ablative, female. The game of available leafage, a viable moth. The game of available algae, a movable...
This is Ira on stage at a small poetry festival in Britain.
The game of available tameable half, if a go. The game of available leave, a flea bag to him.
It's kind of fun when you watch him on stage, which is in deep contrast to how Ira is when it comes to his other passion, which is detecting poetry theft, poetry plagiarism. He's all business when it comes to that.
Okay, so how does he go about this sleuthing? Does he have certain tactics?
He explained a lot of his
So there's a Facebook page that's not quite so active the last time I looked, but has fits and starts. It's called Plagiarism Alerts. And basically people post tips. Like, hey, this looks fishy. Someone investigated. And he just, like a dog to a bone, he just goes after these tips and, like, goes down the rabbit hole searching out the original source material. And we're talking about some pretty obscure poems and poets. So when you have a tip, sometimes it's like, oh, I published this poem in like a journal that came out for 4 issues in the late 90s. And so he'll go and find that journal.
Yeah, he actually described a bit how he digs in when he gets a tip and he starts chasing after it like a ferret.
I would try and take the essence of it, put the kind of crunchy details. That's what I tend to do whenever I'm doing this, kind of the crunchy details of a poem, the odd phrasing, put those into Google next to the word poem and just check through and sift. And that the 2-pack, it showed up that way.
I
bet you got it twisted, you don't know who to
trust. So many player hating, trying to sound like us. Ira found that a French-Canadian poet named Pierre de Risseau, not a totally obscure poet, Canada's 4th parliamentary poet laureate. He actually died in early 2016, but Pierre had plagiarized and translated into French several folks, including Tupac, Dylan Thomas, Charles Bukowski, even Maya Angelou's famous poem, you know, I Rise. You can wipe me from the pages of history with your twisted falsehoods. You can drag me through the mud, but like the wind, I rise. Like that very famous poem. He had...
Wow.
Yeah, I know. So he
I mean, that's crazy. That's almost asking to be found out.
Yeah.
So here's the thing that I love about this is the creativity in this. It's like how many poetry anthologies that actually aren't stolen poetry would have Tupac and Dylan Thomas in the same...
right. And Maya Angelou and Charles Bukowski.
Yeah, can't imagine a more different array of poets brought together in the loving embrace of a poetry thief. That is how Ira would say it.
Yeah.
He doesn't care whether you're a small-time poet in a small town in Britain reading a few poems that you've stolen, or whether you're someone who's been feted by the Canadian Parliament and shamelessly ripping off Tupac and Maya Angelou. It's all the same to Ira. What he cares about is that he's found an example of plagiarism and that he's determined not to let it go unpunished and unexposed.
Is that his motivation, just simply to keep all poets honest?
Well, he did admit in the interview we did with him that he enjoyed the attention. I mean, he's quite... The thing about Ira, which I really admire, is he's quite self-effacing. He's quite honest about his own character, really. But he says that there's something more than just the attention and the sense of righting a wrong. The thing is that it really gives him a greater insight into poetry itself.
I found it really fascinating to approach poetry at the level of pattern. It's a bit like restoring an old master when you have this poem that you can sense is too well written for the plagiarist to have done themselves, but is kind of spoiled or messed about, and you want to find out what the original poem is. And the act of kind of restoring it, of finding the source poem, was actually more... insightful than just reading lots of anthologies or reading lots of poetry books. This has really given me into an insight into why that's a good poem and this is a mess up.
Okay, so that's all very interesting, but I mean, I wonder if it really matters at all. I mean, if somebody's only selling 100 copies, who cares?
Well, I mean, many poets care.
Patrick, as the host of World in Words, I can't believe you'd say something like that.
I'm saying it because you gave me those lines.
Defending the plagiarism.
Well, everybody borrows. We all know this.
Sure.
This is the dirty little secret, isn't it, of the arts?
Yeah. Yes, well, and we're going to get to that point a little bit later in this podcast about that dirty little secret. But I think it's important to actually hear from some of the poets, because it does affect them.
Yeah, we spoke to one poet, and her name is Paisley Rekdal. She's an American poet who had a poem stolen by the same British poet, Christian Ward. And what she said offended her most was not the fact that he'd taken her poem and claimed it as his own. It was the fact that he'd done so without keeping it whole, by making changes. Here's what she told us.
I went from being bemused to being enraged because he didn't keep it as my poem. He tried to change it into his. He changed the rhythms. He deadened the poem. He flattened it out. He wanted to make that poem his in some ways. And that's when I lost all sympathy, oddly. I think if he just kept it as my poem but published it under his name, I wouldn't have felt so angry about that.
Right. He made it worse, according to her. Like, it was sort of taking the artistry out of it, almost.
And she wrote an open letter to Christian Ward, the guy who stole her poem, on her blog, which I just quote you because, and get some of the raw feelings in there. The thing that he did, which she particularly noticed, was that he changed a poem which was written from the point of view of a woman to the point of view of a man. Here's what she said to Christian in an open letter. Bats is a poem about the fear of infidelity and sadness surrounding infertility. It's pretty fucking personal, Christian. And I discovered through your plagiarism that, yes, the speaker's sex does matter. So does her damn identity. Because you fucking added your own line breaks and words. So, not the most traditionally poetic expression, but I think you get the strength of feeling there about what this feels like if you have your own work stolen.
So we had Paisley Rechtel read her original poem, Bats.
Bats unveil themselves in dark. They hang, each a jagged silken sleeve, from moonlit rafters bright as polished knives. They swim the muddied air and keen, like supersonic babies, the sound we imagine empty wombs might make in women who can't fill them up. A clasp, a scratch, a sigh. They drink fruit dry and wheel against feverish light flung hard upon their faces in circles that nauseate. Imagine one at breast or neck, patterning a name in driblets of iodine that spatter your skin and stars. They flutter, shake like mystics. They materialize. Revelatory as a stranger's under things found tossed upon the marital bed, you tremble even at the thought. Asleep, you tear your fingers through your damp neck hair and search the sheets all night.
Okay, so this sounds like Ira has become quite a champion of these poor poets whose poems have been stolen. Great stuff, right?
Sure, except the backlash against Ira has been enormous. Take, for example, the poet plagiarist Christian Ward, who plagiarized Bats. We tried to find him. He was prolific out in the online world, in the poetry world before this whole incident. And today, when we search for him, he has virtually disappeared.
We spent a lot of time, Patrick, trying to find people who Ira has accused of plagiarism or who have admitted plagiarism after Ira exposed them. And in almost every case, there's this really striking pattern that you look up until the date that Ira exposes them, and they have books coming out, they have a Facebook page, they're on Twitter commenting in the poetry community, they're doing readings. And then once it goes up, the flag goes up, this person has stolen poems, everything goes silent, the whole thing goes dark. People's collections are withdrawn. Publishers have very often pulped the books.
Yeah,
pulped the books, exactly. Prizes are withdrawn. And in terms of existing in this small, tight-knit community of poets in Britain, certainly, once the whistle has been blown by Ira, and Ira's, you know, he doesn't do so, he doesn't kind of abuse people online or anything like that. But once his signal has gone up, that is it. And the fact is, we couldn't get anyone to talk to us. And I think that we were told that that reflects just how much of an outcast you become once you're accused of something like plagiarism in this community.
And it doesn't even matter, like, how much you plagiarize, if that makes the sense. Mm-hmm. Like, whether you copied an entire poem outright, whether you took a few words or, like, lifted a phrase, people just kind of disappear.
This whole movement that Ira has led is being enabled by social media. It's the ability of people to come together on a Facebook page and say, hey, I think this poem is plagiarized. Has anyone got a copy of this obscure poetry magazine from the late 90s? Can they scan it? And then people scan it. That's enabled by social media. But equally, the flip side of that community is the shaming that we all know is a big part of social media in so many spheres. Completely applies to this, that once people are exposed, they are outcasts. one of the only sort of viewpoints that we can access from what it feels like to be exposed as a plagiarist by Ira and his movement came from Christian Ward. Now, we can't say for certain it's from Christian Ward.
The right. plagiarist poet.
Exactly that one. But in a newspaper article about Ira's work, underneath the line, there were comments from readers. And one person commented under the name Christian Ward. It's quite a long posting, quite a painful, raw posting. I'll just give you a little flavor of some of it. The debacle has been one of the most uncomfortable and distressing experiences of my life. I've been bullied, victimized, and abused by a number of poets who thought it was necessary to act like a lynch mob. I have become extremely depressed by their actions and don't deserve it. I'm not the complete monster that a lot of people think I am. I'm a human being and I deserve better. And he also apologized for what he'd done in that message as well.
So I can almost hear listeners now being like, well, it's his fault. He plagiarized. Ah! Like plagiarism is bad.
I don't know. I kept going backwards and forwards. I don't know about you, Nina, but I couldn't make my mind up on this. Of like, when I was speaking to Ira, I was feeling like, yeah, he's actually stopping their work being stolen. When I heard the poets who were stolen from, like Paisley, when she talks about being enraged and feeling like something had been taken from her, I was on their side.
So we couldn't find any of the plagiarists, but we did find a publisher who has published one of the accused plagiarists.
Andy Smokestack.
That can't be his last name.
Andy Smokestack. Yeah. That's fantastic.
It's not his last name. That no effing way.
That sounds like the bass player in a punk band from the north of England.
I wouldn't be surprised if there are a few demo tapes in his garage. But his name's Andy Croft. He runs a publishing house which publishes poems called Smokestack Books. He was angry when we spoke to him. And he's the other side of this. Because, as Nina just said, he published a poet who was accused by Ira of plagiarism. And let me be honest, it's pretty conclusive, the evidence that this poet, she had plagiarized another poem. But what he wanted to speak about was the impact that Ira's work has had on the poetry community. Have a listen to what he said. And I have to just say this. He opened this part of the interview with the most British metaphor I've ever heard in an interview, and I've been a BBC journalist for 9 years.
I describe what Ira Lightman does as poking around in the marmalade looking for a dead fly, which probably isn't there. It's starting a fight where there needn't be one, is causing a problem where there doesn't have to be one. I've inhabited the world of poetry fairly intensely for the last 3 decades. And the British poetry world, I think it's fair to characterise it, is not a very friendly or welcoming place at the best of times. But in the last few years, it seems to have narrowed, diminished its ambitions. One of the elements that have narrowed and soured the contemporary British poetry world is the whole idea that the very notion of property coming into poetry of all things.
Just to be clear, maybe in some cases it is, but he's definitely uncovered things that are a lot more than just a phrase borrowed.
And so what? If a friend of mine was making a real fool of themselves in their personal life, in their professional life, I'd try and say something to them before it got public, before they made a public fool of themselves. Someone needs to do this. This should all be done carefully and kindly and quietly with discretion and diplomacy and affection, not this kind of burning crosses on the front lawn thing.
I think the most British thing you said in that whole clip is that everything should be done carefully, quietly, discreetly. That seems like a very British feeling. It's very American to burn crosses on the lawn, sadly.
Well, we put Andy's points to Ira, and Ira immediately seized on the marmalade metaphor, as a good poet should.
I don't push any spoons into anything. I wait for people to bring the first case to me. What I would say is what I say to lots of people who take this approach with me: what would you have done? Yeah. Because a lot of people seem to think there is an alternative way of doing it. What they mean is they're uncomfortable with what's happened. Everyone's always uncomfortable. People nick things. People can be kleptomaniacs. People can do all sorts of things that does actually cause harm. I don't think you just turn a blind eye to it. But I think there's a lot of this kind of, oh, this is uncomfortable, I don't want any of this brought out. Well, what would you have done? The problem with contemporary poetry is not these very few bad apples. It's not that half the poems you're going to find in a book or in a magazine are plagiarisms. The problem is that it's being considered to be no problem whatsoever, which is then being used to cover up. And that is awful. And that I've seen lots of examples of.
So I think I've got the arguments on both sides here. And they're both certainly compelling ones. But I'm not sure if I know what plagiarism is anymore.
Well, Patrick, we asked everyone we spoke to what they consider plagiarism to be. And like you, I kind of thought this was a fairly simple question. It's about stealing someone else's work and not explaining where you got it from. But it actually gets pretty complicated. And what I began to realize, and we began to realize as we spoke to all these people, is that it's not just about copying, it's about authorship.
And some, you know, might say in this modern world where we have influences from all sorts of things and all sorts of media, there is no such thing as plagiarism.
Hi, I'm Kenneth Goldsmith, and I'm a poet who lives in New York City. I teach at the University of Pennsylvania.
Kenneth, are you a plagiarist?
I am indeed.
What is a plagiarist?
Well, a plagiarist is somebody who takes somebody else's words and claims them as their own. I mean, I think it's really time to decriminalize this act and maybe name it something else. You know, I mean, we have the word appropriation, which has a long history in the arts, going all the way back to Duchamp, where one takes something from the world and simply reframes it without doing much else to it. Thereby, the act is an original act of unoriginal genius.
So, yeah, Kenneth Goldsmith, another poet with a big personality here. And Kenneth has made a whole career about blurring the line deliberately and openly, as you heard there, trying to decriminalize, in his words, the idea of plagiarism. His most famous poem, if you can call it a poem, is Day. Now, what he did with Day was to take every single word in one edition of the New York Times and reproduce it as a poem.
Day, E28. The New York Times, Friday, September 1st, 2000.
As a kind of, I guess, making choices, statement about how we understand history or how we understand our society. But that's probably very naive of me to try and pin a single motive. Meaning on it.
Stieglitz, Weston, Adams and Callahan, Modern Living 2, New York Salon, The Observer, Cartier-Bresson, After the War, Paris Salon, The Rhetoric of Persuasion, Seeing Double, Piercing Beauty, Lots of Sexy Ugliness, and A Wealth of Challenging Ideas. MoMA, the Museum of Modern Art, 11 West 53rd Street, New York, New York, 212-708.
So Goldsmith obviously has been very critical of what Ira has been doing.
Well, I know Ira Lightman as an innovative poet, a very small press guy. And I think poets are always looking for ways to get a little bit of attention. Ira has found a little niche there to get people to pay attention to him. And God bless him. Us poets get no attention. I get his marketing angle.
I mean, some people feel it's more than a marketing angle, that he's really doing something that is to do with right and wrong and theft and people's having their hard work taken from them. Don't get that feeling from you, is that right?
I think he's a troll. But, you know, poets have nothing but time on their hands. So, you know, I think he's found a way to fill his time by trolling other poets.
Wow, this is interesting. I'm not sure if I agree that everything that Ira does is wrong. Maybe the method that he uses is kind of harsh, or maybe it's just the fact that social media makes it harsh. But I'm not sure if I buy the fact that all Ira is a troll. On some level, there is a degree to which he is doing some good if he could do it in maybe, you know, as was suggested before, a quieter way. That might be better.
And maybe not taking people off, you know, like his campaigns have had direct impact on some poets' lives, like going after poets who have, you know, a university position, for example.
Yeah, changing the mood of the community. I mean, that's what Andy Croft said.
Destroying the tight-knit British poetry scene.
I'm just trying to put myself in the shoes of all of these people here. And I think first and foremost, if you're a poet, and I'm not, I've never written any poetry, but if I wrote some poetry, I imagine that it would feel extremely personal, like that woman we heard from at the very beginning. Mm-hmm. And if somebody then took it and changed it a little bit, I would be outraged. I really would be outraged. And I think they have every right to be outraged.
But if, like, say, Kanye West sampled your poem and took it and changed it a little bit.
And acknowledged it. I mean, wasn't that the whole battle with sampling that they acknowledged?
So that's the, like, critical piece.
Yeah, I mean, that's really interesting you should say that, because this is one thing that Kenneth talks a lot about. He says, you know, in an era of sampling and in music, people like Iris should have less sort of a Victorian attitude about owning a poem for all time. Anyone can take it. Anyone can quote from it. When you sample, you often make it clear where the sample's from. And when he quoted the entire New York Times, it's very obvious what the New York Times is. It's not as though anyone could be under any illusion that this didn't have an origin in the New York Times or an origin in another place. And this is one of the things that really interests me with Kenneth. And I pressed him a little bit on this. Have a listen. Do you ever plagiarize things where people won't be aware that there's a different source without contacting someone? Do you ever take from another artist's work who's not famous, not an obvious quotation, without telling them?
No, I don't. I don't do that. I've never done that with individuals. As a matter of fact, I did a giant 1,000-page work of citation in which hundreds and hundreds of authors were quoted, and also I sourced the quotes for them. I didn't get permission, but I credited them. I think on a personal level, I would like to see this become a collaborative process, although it's not what I do. Again, I plagiarize from media bodies.
Kenneth, I think you're not a plagiarist. I hate to break it to you. You're using that word provocatively and interestingly, but what you're doing is quoting people. You would never take the real step of a real plagiarist of quoting from someone else's work without any sign that you have an alternative source.
Well, I think, again, it comes back to semantics, and I'd like to see the word plagiarism go away. Mm-hmm. Let's just use these types of literary methodologies as another tool in our toolbox. One last story. I've been teaching for the past, you know, nearly 20 years a class called On Creative Writing, in which my students must not be creative. They are penalized if they are being original. And they must plagiarize for the entire semester, everything. And then we examine what they plagiarized and why they plagiarized it. And in fact, the notion of choice is expressive and it's personal, as if it was a normal piece of creative writing. There's always autobiography in choice. Choice is authorship. Even if you're choosing somebody else's words, you are expressing who you are through that choice. And when you sit down and you articulate it, you find that this is legitimate expression. It's just not accepted as such.
Can I call bullshit on that?
Yeah. That's how I feel about that. I mean, I do agree that choice is... there's like an authorship in what you choose, but I also think you have to know the rules before you can break them. Do you know what I mean?
Right,
it's totally.
And you have to acknowledge what you're doing.
For me, it's that he knows that it sounds more provocative and controversial and daring if he calls what he's doing plagiarism. But it's not really plagiarism to me, because he, as he says himself, makes it very clear that he's quoting something and recontextualizing it. So it's actually quotation, but that's a lot less exciting as a concept than decriminalizing quotation, which isn't even a problem at the moment.
Patrick, I think the one thing that we need to disclose about Kenneth Goldsmith that is really interesting is that, you know, he's done all these sort of plagiarized works, but there's one plagiarized work in which he got a lot of crap for.
So it's funny that, because earlier in our interview, he used the word appropriation. And it's in fact the idea of cultural appropriation, which has made Kenneth quite controversial. In 2015, Kenneth performed a work of found poetry, large-scale plagiarism, as he would say. The particular work that he was performing was to read the entire autopsy report of Michael Brown, a African-American teenager who was killed by the police. He read every single word of that autopsy report as a kind of found poem, as a plagiarized poem, as he would say, in the same way he did with the New York Times piece. Now, he insists that he did this to reveal the brutality of the violence that was visited on Michael Brown. But many people felt that actually taking something like this, plagiarizing something that's so sensitive, was actually, in fact, a completely unethical act of cultural appropriation. And that kind of plagiarism is wrong in the eyes of many of his critics in a completely different way from the way that Ira Lightman would criticize him. So there's all sorts of different directions in which this issue of plagiarism and poetry and who has the right to use what poem gets so much more complicated and widens out into so many bigger conversations about politics and society.
Right. And I think the important thing about that Kenneth Goldsmith retelling of Michael Brown's autopsy report was that he changed the order in which the report was written. So he put certain elements like up front that were a little seen as unsavory. But it does come to a point, as Leo is saying, it's far more complicated than just taking someone's words. There are all sorts of sticky and messy issues. Like the poet Paisley Rekdal was saying a little bit earlier about changing a gender of a poem and changing who is saying the poem, what it means. It gets so much more complicated.
Yeah, it does seem to. And this also makes me think that it's all to do with context and framing. If you take somebody's poets, as we heard before, and change the time and the place, that can sometimes be a really liberating thing. I mean, look at Shakespeare over the years, who himself kind of plagiarized other people's storylines. Well, his own plays were then taken and reset in other times and places all over the world.
But that's, I think, true. The point is about power in a way, because, you know, when Kenneth Goldsmith quotes the New York Times in its entirety, it's not really like it's any skin off the New York Times nose. And when a storyline from Shakespeare is reappropriated somewhere else, it's not as though Shakespeare needs any increase in his reputation. Where this is, like, for me, a genuine ethical issue is when you're talking about a poet who's kind of struggling to make their way in America or Britain, and they open their favorite poetry journal, and they see their own work suddenly appearing with someone's name underneath. And that, to me, is just a world away from quoting the New York Times or taking the plot from Romeo and Juliet. To me, anyway, at the end of this story, I felt like there's still something very strong to Ira's stance, but that's maybe just how I felt by the end of this.
I mean, I guess the whole question is like, where is the line? At what point does it cross over into something that is wrong? And at what point is it just actually acknowledging and sampling? Is keeping the structure and changing the place names, is that an homage, or is that just literally someone who's not creative enough to come up with their own poem?
Have either of you guys ever been plagiarized?
Been plagiarized? Not that I know of. I have a story of plagiarism.
Ooh, you have plagiarized.
Have you?
Maybe in an essay at high school or college when I was running out of time, if I plagiarized. I might have done. I don't know.
Well, I can tell you the story of when I first learned the word plagiarism. I mean, I think I always like knew what it was as an elementary school kid. But in the sixth grade, I wrote, in English class, I wrote a story. I was really taken with this stupid Chipmunks movie. It's like the Chipmunks' Great Adventure, and they go in this hot air balloon, and they have this great adventure. And I didn't know any better, or I thought I was super clever, and I basically wrote a story that was like using the whole plot of Chipmunks' Great Adventure. It wasn't like line for line plagiarized, but like all the beats of the story. And I will never forget this ever to this day. My teacher photocopied my essay, handed it out to the entire class, and basically railed against it in front of the whole class. I was in tears in the back and talked about how this is wrong and this is plagiarism and you can't take somebody's ideas. It constricts my throat right now. I mean, it was a good lesson for me because I didn't know any better.
Totally give you a pass. You're a sixth grader.
I know, but like, it totally affected me.
Wow.
Anyway.
How about you, Leo?
Well, I must admit, I've got sweaty palms right now because I've got to admit a slightly more recent crime of plagiarism. Some parts of this story, in fact, have been plagiarized. In fact, some of the opening lines of this podcast.
You bad boy.
Bad.
I just realized, as so many poets have before me, that this other writer got it done it better than me. And Will Storr from The Guardian, all I can say is thank you. Your description of Ira was, I couldn't better it, so I just took it.
And that is the end of our story today. The end.
Thanks, Leo. Thanks, Nina.
Thank you.
Thanks very much, Patrick. And I'll be copying some more things and stealing them from other places for the World in Words in future, I'm sure.
Today's episode was reported by Leo Hornack and Nina Porzuki. It was mixed and sound designed by Tina Toby. Big thanks to Will Storr of The Guardian, of course, and to everyone else who we borrowed words from. Do please give us a review wherever you listen to The World in Words. You've heard me say it before, you've probably heard it from others too. But you know, more reviews mean more listeners. And that's always good. Best way to contact me is on Twitter. I'm at Patricox, PatriCox. Thanks for listening. We'll be back soon.
David Seville is going on a trip to Europe and is not taking the chipmunks.
Please, take me with you, Dave. You've got to see the chipmunk adventure. I'm really great.
Alvin!
I can't remember when I've had such a good time, Alvin.